You go on. No? Canon 1095 to 1107. In other words, these are all the questions regarding possible declaration of invalid marriage or dissolution. 1095, incapable of contracting a marriage, who are incapable of contracting a marriage. First, a person who does not have sufficient use of reason. And the church's law now makes clear, remembers what the age for valid marriage is.
15 for girls.
Are you sure?
No. 16.
And we could talk more about that, because sometimes people may reach a certain age but not really know enough about what marriage is to be validly married. So there is, or suffer from grave lack of discretion of judgment on the essential rights and duties of marriage. And that in our country, I think, is more widespread than most of us realize. Again, canon, unable to assume essential matrimonial obligations due to psychic conditions. And this is where, especially now, with the number of handicapped children is increasing more than any other period in American history. And mainly because of the amount of drugs being consumed. Some time ago, I may have had occasion to tell you, the children, especially the first child of a marriage, both Catholics, well, the husband was heavily addicted to marijuana, which is supposed to be a mild drug, but was heavily addicted to marijuana. When he married and when the children were conceived. And so in order to satisfy certain conditions which had to be verified, I had some research done by the Georgetown Medical School and have the documentation in my files. All the children of parents, whether mother or father, who are on marijuana are permanently damaged. All the children, whether mother or father, are on marijuana, probably damaged. Lord, where is our country going? No fault, obviously, of the children. For those children even to enter into a valid marriage. I should add, by the way, and the church declared a nullity on that first marriage. Never in the history of canon law has the church made so many stipulations, things we never have thought of before But nowadays, because especially in so-called affluent country like ours, to enter a really valid contract, how many people, how many Americans are in their right mind? I think I should quote my very dear friend from St. Louis, a priest. I may have quoted this too, but I don't think I did, especially being taped. I think the United States is a national insane asylum. And the caretakers of the asylum are running the country. It's not even moral theology, it's common sense. Then the Canon 1096, parties must know that marriage is lifelong and open to having children. How many Americans? Notice, it's not a question of knowing, or not a question of believing, but of knowing that marriage is a lifelong contract. How many young people are learning this in school? When books still talk this way, when movie scenarios or television programs, and open to having children. A couple that parents asked me to counsel here at the university in Detroit. Finally, we have the date, wedding date set. Would I please give the instructions? Again, I must have said this on some occasion, at least to some of you. And he was not a Catholic, not baptized. And the girl was, well, apparently a good Catholic. So I asked, do you want children? Oh, yes. But both said not right away. Well, how long will you wait? Well, it depends. Well, can you some figure? Well, maybe 3 years, maybe 4 years, maybe 5 years. I'll take one more and then we'll take up your questions. 1097. Error regarding the person does not invalidate unless directly and principally intended. Meaning what? First of all, and there are stories, I'm sure you may have read some novels on the subject, but it's part of history, that a man married, well, a girl's twin sister. The two were planted this way. I mean, the two twins. What the canon says is, in itself, here regarding the person, in other words, the least that a husband or prospective husband or wife should know, at least know whom they're marrying, know their name, address. It helps to have the telephone number. And at least enough about the person to be able to say, yes, I know who he or who she is. Can there be error? Yes. Can there be deliberate error on the part, say, of the partner who deceives in order to get married? Yes. For example, suppose a man says and asks the girl, "I want to marry a virgin. Are you a virgin?" She says, "Yes." Now, look, if you're not, tell me, "Are you a virgin?" She said, "Yes." But she's not. Is that marriage valid? No. Does that make sense? Now, the condition need not be a condition, say, for having a valid marriage in the first place. But when we marry, well, to say the least, we do have the option to marry whom we wish. Now, the family may think they're making the most stupid choice of all life. That's their problem. But we marry whom we want. But we've got to know enough about the person. At least, as the canon says, if it is, the error would be directly intended if the one who is in error has been deceived by the other partner. That would be a directly intended error and principally intended. In other words, that the error was intended by the one who wants to get married and knows and must be sure knows that the person he or she is dating would not marry this person if they knew. For example, if, say, the girl thinks that the boy she wants to marry is fertile, that she could conceive. Turns out, he is not. And if there was, remember, error in the sense that he married the wrong person because he thought, or she thought in this case, that he was fertile and he wasn't. Or he thought she was a virgin and she wasn't. Am I still clear? All of those factors, those single factors, would invalidate a marriage contract. And with that, let's pick up the questions. Are there any questions? What is the first purpose of marriage? Procreation of children or love of the partner? Has this been redefined since Vatican II? It has not been redefined. It does not need redefinition. The first purpose is the procreation and education of children. But then the Church has to define the meaning of first. The first purpose is that the other purpose, the fostering mutual love, may not be subordinated. Either way, in other words, you may not subordinate the procreation of children to foster mutual love. So, the first purpose is still procreation and education of children. The trouble with the first word first, it's misleading. It means, in the mind of the Church, primary purpose, a purpose that cannot be subordinated to any other. In other words, you may not subordinate the procreation of children, conception of children, to the fostering of mutual love. We will foster our mutual love more if we don't have children, and we use means to avoid having children. Well, An 8-year-old student of mine said that she was going to get married when she was 16 and divorced when she was 21. This is not uncommon. Like I told you, New York City, I know. Jewish people marry and they even sign their divorce contract the day of their marriage. Assuming they won't divorce is a bit unique, but not so unusual. People living, you know, just without any commitment on either side for so many years, and then that's the end of it. Took a class at Sacred Heart Seminary. Father X said there is no such person as Abraham in the Old Testament. Could you explain? I didn't want to pronounce the priest's name. This priest, X, named on this card, is all wet. Oh, my friends, I have a rich vocabulary, which I seldom use. I don't want to use the words I would like to use. That's why my Vatican superiors are so right. Most of the priests in America ordained since Vatican II should be re-educated with a questioner of this. Please tell the priest to make an appointment with Father Hardin or bring him to the university, please. Very happy to meet with His Reverence. Christ's lineage to the twelve tribes of Israel in particular, David's line, makes me fear that the divinity of Christ is questioned by this priest. I know what else he questions. What he should question is his own intelligence. Oh, I did tell you about my professor in scripture, happened to be Old Testament. All kinds of wild ideas about the Old Testament. I told you about him. So we had two term papers every semester. My term papers were always a refutation of my teacher. And being an honest man, he would write another paper refuting me and give me a good grade. Oh. What is a Petrine privilege? That's the name given to the case where one person is baptized and the other is not baptized, and then say the baptized, for that matter, or the non-baptized person becomes a Catholic, and then they cannot live together peacefully. The church then can dissolve that non-sacramental marriage. Follow it? Validly married, maybe in a Catholic church, but no sacrament. But then, if the, and can work either way, either the baptized person becomes a Catholic, or the non-baptized person becomes a Catholic, and cannot live peaceably with the other partner, that first marriage can be dissolved. Why? Because it is not a sacrament. Does the church assume Protestant marriages are indissoluble? Oh, no. The church assumes that Protestant marriages are sacramental marriages. Of course, you'd have to prove in case the marriage, say, should be dissolved, they want to dissolve, you'd have to prove then that either one or both of the fathers and partners, was now baptized. But secondly, and this is over the years, and teaches, I think I've told you, in six Protestant seminaries, all the time I would spend on marriage, because not one of the founders of Protestantism, not Luther, not Calvin, not Zwingli, not Cranmer, none of them believed that marriage is indissoluble. Not one. That's why Protestantism got started. Catholics wanted divorce and remarry. So they found a priest by the name of Luther. Oh, well, obliged them. It's not a new religion to do it. That's the origins of Protestantism. Having taught for 7 years at Lutheran Seminary, stories I could tell you. Now they take notes furiously. My judges even paid money for my teaching these Lutherans. So that's another ground for Protestant marriage being questionable, because they don't believe that the marriage is for life. Get it? Then you do not enter a valid contract in the first place. I know of no Protestant denomination in the world that has not approved contraception. Same thing. For instance, a Protestant couple, one divorced and remarried, both want to become Catholic. Can they be admitted to the sacraments? Well, nearly one. You get a problem on both sides, because if the divorced one is not yet remarried, then they want to be remarried. And they have to go back on what I just said before, remember? Their previous Protestant marriage could be declared null and void, either because even one had not been baptized, certainly not only baptized before marriage, or either one did not really intend to enter a lifelong union, or either one did not really want children. Can they admit to the sacraments? And they should give you. You may have read. In Germany, there are now some German bishops that are telling people, these are, say, Catholics, divorced and remarried, to receive the sacraments. And one of the bishops, whom I happen to know, wrote a book on Christ. It's called Jesus Christ, translated from the German. I read that book, and it affected work that I was doing. I paid dearly for refusing to accept that bishop's writings in the course that I was involved with. So the United States is not the only one having trouble. Our bishops have strange ideas. When we say, in the anima Christi, water from the side of Christ wash me, what does this mean? Well, of course, we're using symbolic language. In other words, Christ, who bled, as we know, on the cross, and shed both blood and water. Well, the water, as you know, is symbolic for cleansing. So Christ, by his death on the cross, cleansed the world of its sins. When I asked a young priest, 45 years old, if he were a a medal or the scapular? He said, no. When he asked why, he replied, Jesus wore no medal. I said nothing. My handy, yeah, he said, medic medal. He took it. What would be a good reply? Oh, Jesus did not have to wear medals. My gosh, that's easy. However, it would be a good thing to have. Carry medals with you and get them blessed beforehand. And distribute medals. Sure. How big or small are angels? Well, angels, remember, they are spirits. They have no quantity. Big or small has to do with size. Should the Catholic parents absent themselves from the marriage of their child in an un-Catholic marriage? Well, if indeed the Catholic child is marrying outside the church, I would ask, may the Catholic parents absent themselves from the marriage of their child where the marriage is not blessed by the church? May they? Yes. May they attend the marriage? My advice over the years has always been no. However, depending on whom I'm talking to, I tell them, if you want to, you may. The important thing, of course, is not to give parental consent to what is not a real marriage. True love must be based on the truth. Can, under certain circumstances, a Catholic parent attend the non-Catholic invalid marriage of their son or daughter? They can, but I repeat, I never advise it. And that's because of the scandal. Should Catholic parents attend the second marriage of their divorced child? Same thing. Is a mass valid if the priest does not intend to consecrate and or does not believe he can? No. If he does not intend to consecrate, there's no consecration. If he does not believe he can, I'll take that back. If he is validly ordained himself, and even though he has lost his faith, but nevertheless wants to do what the people expect him to do. Now, of course, if he doesn't believe that he can consecrate, his logic would be a little mixed up. He went through the ceremony. On the other hand, if he doesn't believe that he has the power of consecration, and I repeat, but he's been validly ordained. Rome tells me, in the history of the church, there has never been, or have never been, more requests for declaration of nullity of ordination than in our day. Priests not knowing what they were being ordained for. And I know them. And they find out, no, I don't want to be that. And of course, they've got to prove their case involved. Declaration of nullity. So, however, in an absolute sense, provided the priest, somebody get me more water, please. Is there water here?
Marianne?
Provided a priest First of all, he has to be validly ordained, obviously. Nothing happens unless he is. He has lost his faith in his own priesthood, which is the main reason why priests leave the church. I keep telling people, it's not women, it's not authority, it's not alcohol, it's not sex, it's faith. A man loses his faith in his own priesthood. Now, if he had been validly ordained, but has lost his faith in his own priesthood, can he still validly consecrate? Yes. But what he wants to do with the people, the stupid people that he is serving, expect him to do. Am I making sense? And the church has taught this and teaches it to protect the faithful. Is this true? Two Protestants get married and they are validly baptized. Of course, they do not have the sacrament of reconciliation available. If one or both ever committed a mortal sin since baptism, there is no sacrament of marriage. No, there is a sacrament of marriage. Two Catholics, don't have to be two Protestants, two Catholics, both in mortal sin, when they marry, their marriage is valid. They receive the sacrament of marriage. They do not receive the grace of the sacrament of marriage, which is a real tragedy. And that's one reason why the church is so strongly discouraging mixed marriages. Because even if the non-Catholic party is baptized and there's been a valid marriage, but in this case, the Catholic partner, say in the state of grace, would receive the grace of the sacrament. But if they do not receive the grace of the sacrament, well, there's all theological comfort knowing your husband, all right, I receive the sacrament of marriage, so is my husband, but he did not receive the grace of the sacrament, but I've got to live with him. So, the marriage, therefore, is valid. There's a sacrament received, but the graces of the sacrament are not received until either one or the other, and even one, returns to the state of grace, and thus then receives the graces that were due when the sacrament was first received. How do we explain to a Baptist that we are not cannibals, even though we eat Christ's body and blood, solo divinity? Well, obviously, Christ faced that problem with his own Jews long before the Baptists came into existence, remember? Well, we're not cannibals. Why not? Because although Christ's body and blood are really, truly, physically contained in the Holy Eucharist, they do not have the external, sensible properties of human body and human blood. And consequently, we receive Christ's body and blood, all right. But the physical properties, and that's the only thing that is, you might say, nasty about cannibalism, is because when a human being is eaten, you have the sensible physical properties of a human body. The living body and blood of Christ are there, but they are not sensibly either perceptible or, shall I say, cuttable or eatable or tasteable. Okay, thanks for the question. Well, I never know what question I'm going to get. Is immersion a valid form of baptism in the Catholic Church? It is. It is valid. However, be sure that the head is immersed. And now, it'll keep the baby out of the water for 10 minutes. The head should be immersed. And that is as the church is teaching. That's why my aspersion, which is pouring, is the head that is covered with water. In case of emergency, say, a difficult delivery of a child, and the head is not delivered first, and the child is in danger of dying, may the feet be baptized? Yes. On the possibility or likelihood that that's a valid baptism. Am I clear? Be sure in immersion, a baby's head or adult for that matter, and of course, close their lips. If they swallow some water, it won't kill them. And the head should be immersed. Could you please define what channel of grace means? What does it mean to be someone's channel of grace? Thank you. Well, in the Catholic Church, we speak of two basic kinds of grace. One is called internal grace, and the other is called external grace. What is internal grace? What is sanctifying grace? It elevates our souls to the supernatural life. And actual grace, which is the enlightenment of the mind and strengthening of the will. But internal grace is spiritual. It is, well, internal. It's in the soul. What is external grace? External grace is every person, place, or thing, every person, place, or thing that God uses as a means of conferring his internal grace. And thus, for example, I want to think that I am an external grace for all of you in what I'm teaching you. When I write a book, that book is an external grace. Now, these external graces can be either pleasant or unpleasant. Somebody frowns at me. Or gives me, as we say, well, a bad look. Is that a grace? Yes. God wants me to, by this, say, painful episode, to obtain grace from God, to obtain for grace from God for the practice, say, of patience, of charity. So, what's a channel of grace? A channel of grace is every creature that God uses as a means of conferring his grace on a human being. Thus, we are all men. You're all meant to be channels of grace to one another. Wives to their husbands. Husbands to their wives. And I tell married people, and the most important grace in your life, say, it's a married woman, is your husband. In God's ordinary providence. In fact, one of my favorite definitions of the apostolate. The apostolate is being a channel of grace to others. And God never wastes anything in the world. Never. Anything. He intends everything in our lives to be a channel of grace. Thank you. Oh. When a child is in danger of death at birth, is it proper to baptize without the parents' permission? Oh, sure, gracious. Like, asking the parents' permission, you want your child to go to heaven. Sure, baptize the baby. That is, a pregnant mother gives birth after a traffic accident and you are present. Oh, sure. My record was giving 6 baptisms on one occasion after a reveal accident. Baptized all 6 people. I was going to Ann Arbor to give a lecture at the University of Michigan.
The Institute on Religious Life has presented these lectures by Father John A. Hardin, S.J. All rights are reserved. Any duplication or reproduction of this material in any media form without the express written consent of the Institute on Religious Life is strictly prohibited. For more information on other material in this series or on the Institute on Religious Life, call area code 313-930-7470.